Hi there, Ami and Danta. This is The Commentator's Curse. We've reached episode 10 of this mighty tome. This is the show where we kind of lift the lid about the world of commentators. It's a weird world that we inhabit. I've been doing it for over 20 years. Every game I attend, I bump into people that I've maybe never met before or I've met countless times before. Commentators all have a different story to tell about how they got to where they are today and how they've stayed where they are. It's always fascinating. There's always great tales to tell about the journey that people take. As I mentioned, this is episode 10, so episodes 1 to 9 are available on our archive. You can find from episode 1 with Guy Mowbray and Ian Crocker right the way through to the most recent episode we did for episode 9. And they're all there. They're all about an hour long. Now, let's introduce my two guests for today's episode. My first guest is one of my TalkSport colleagues. He not only specializes in football commentary, but also he is the voice of Super League on the TalkSport network, having done rugby league for an awfully long time. But he came through in his native Yorkshire. And I'm delighted to say, well, recently, he's also joined me as part of our darts coverage across the TalkSport network. It's Mark Wilson who's with us on The Commentator's Curse. Morning, Mark.
Morning, mate. How are you doing?
Yes, sound as a pound. Nice to have you with us. And my other guest is a fellow Midlander, although he doesn't, like me, live in the Midlands. He has been a South Coast man for a very long time as the sports editor of BBC Radio Solent, but his main gig within that is to be a Southampton commentator, which he's done well, pretty much ever since I've known him. But he's got a journey that, like me, has seen him come through in West Midland radio stations. Adam Blackmore from BBC Radio Solent is our other guest. Morning to you, Adam.
Morning, Dance.
Nice to speak to you, mate. It's nice to have you both on. You are a Midlander, Adam, but, you know, obviously, like me, you don't live in the Midlands anymore. How long have you been down on the South Coast now?
I've been down in Radio Solent since 2004. When I started there. Before that, I was at BBC Radio Northampton for 4.5 years. And then, as you said, started out with BBC Hereford and Worcester and BBC WM, your rivals when you were at BRMB, the old days.
That's the thing, though, isn't it? Hands across the airwaves. I talk about it so much with this podcast. Obviously, we've got Wills with me, who's my TalkSport colleague, but BBC and local radio, there isn't quite the warring factions that people might think between the two, is there?
I don't think so. I don't know what Mark thinks, but when we all get to a game, whether it's cricket, football, rugby, whatever, at the end of the day, we all need each other sometimes. You know, we all understand what we're all trying to do, and there's nothing worse than when your kit doesn't work or your mic breaks. You damn well need to be nice to people year in, year out, because you never know when you're going to need them. At the end of the day, we all help each other out when we have to.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think certainly the COVID situation has helped with that, I think, because we've had to get along, haven't we? And I think that really has helped things. But I'm, you know, I'm like Adam, I think I've always got spare kit in my bag and I'm not bothered who needs to use it. If it needs using, it needs using. And I hope one day that if I need it, someone will be there to lend me some kit. So I think you should treat people as you wish to be treated yourself.
Yeah. Really good point, actually, about COVID, Mark. About it sort of concentrated the fact that there was only us inside the stadium in Project Restart. There were the players, there were the ancillary staff, and there was us. And so we all understood the privilege that we had to be there. But you're right. That meant that the relationships, the interpersonal relationships between us all in the press box just intensified that little bit.
Yeah, it did, because, you know, normally we're used to sitting on our own little spots at grounds and basically we sat where we were told to sit and we didn't move anywhere else. And if that meant, you know, maybe we had to plug into the opposite ISDN and they used ours, all of a sudden it wasn't a problem. I think, like you said, we're all just grateful to be there and probably aware of our responsibilities, that we had a job to do for the people that couldn't be there. And I think it made us even more important than maybe we were before.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Never have we needed so much gaffer tape in our lives, God.
Yeah, suddenly you need 100-metre long ISDN cables when normally a 5-metre one would suffice. But there we go. Needs must as the devil drives, isn't it? So Adam, let's go back to the start with you and how your journey began. Because I know I say this every single episode. Everybody's got a unique journey, and your journey is almost as unique as my stupid journey via banking and guitar sales into radio. So take us back to what at school and whether you had radio as a viable career option in your mind?
I'll keep it brief. I'll try to dance, but yeah, I love me and you for the fact that we came out of it through a passion for sport rather than doing a media degree and thinking we had some sort of divine right to work in radio. I had a good education. I was privately educated, didn't make the most of that. I came out of Birmingham like you, but I got a sort of musical scholarship at a good school when I was 11. And when I didn't start in radio trying to be a broadcaster till I was 28. So I spent 10 years wasting my education, doing various jobs, driving vans, working down sewers, running pubs, which was always something I enjoyed. And I did that. But when I look back at it as a kid, I look back and think, I wonder if it started when I used to play Sabutio every night of my life. And I used to also record football matches on the old BBC Radio 2 and then listen back to them. And this was probably when I was 9 or 10. So I never thought of it again about doing it until I was 28. Mm-hmm. So it was weird, but it was sat there somewhere that I used to listen back to commentaries just for my own entertainment.
So when did things switch gears then? When did something come along that gave you an opportunity?
Well, what happened was, and I said I'll try and be brief. I ended up in Malvern near Worcester. I met a woman who had 5 kids. I became a dad to all of them when I was 25, and I suddenly realised, or 23, I had to grow up a bit and be responsible. And I loved, you know, having the kids, but I was doing rubbish jobs, and we were living in a council house, and you know, life was going nowhere fast. And as I got older, I knew I was wasting my education more and more. You know, you get more not desperate, but you sort of regrets start building up. And then I had an old PE teacher from my school. People will love this. They think we're all, you know, educated and media trained and all this. And basically, he used to come around to my house because his wife didn't like him betting. So he used to come and watch the Monday night football or with Andy Gray at the time, of course, on Sky. And this is 1996, by the way. He used to come round and have a bet on the phone in my house on the shirt numbers or corners or whatever he was doing. And we used to watch the game. Now, because he was an old teacher of mine and he knew I had ability, he was frustrated I wasn't doing better with my life. And when we watched the football, I used to say things that Andy Gray would then say, just as an observer. I used to point things out. And eventually he got annoyed and said to me, "Why don't you do something about this? You know, you could do this. Why don't you go and report on the radio or something?" And I said, "Well, I haven't got a clue." So I basically wrote a letter to a guy called Dave Bradley, who's still at BBC Hereford and Worcester, who's a legend there, famous for his cricket, really. And he was the sports producer there. And we'd played cricket together for a village team a few years before. It's as simple as that. And I wrote him a letter and said, "Can I come and learn the radio? Can I do some matches or something?" And he said, "Look, I've got no money. I've got no budget. But if you want to watch Hereford Rugby Club," because I was a useful rugby player when I was younger, he said, "if you want to go and watch Hereford, you can do match reports on me. I've got £10 for you." So I was doing mobile phone side of the pitch reports with a brolly at Hereford Rugby Club for a whole season, 96-97, up and down the country, even to Aspatria in Cumbria for a tenner, and traveling with the team and just doing reports on a mobile phone. And it just sort of gave me a bug. And after a year of that, he said, look, you've got some talent. He gave me some cricket commentary to do and various things. And then he said, "I can't do any more for you. I'll tell Tim Beach, who's a legend at BBC WM, you could go and do Moseley Rugby for them." So that happened. And then I got a Saturday gig with WM doing reports, and suddenly realised I was a very small cog in a big wheel as I talked too much over the football commentaries to bring them the latest from the rugby. Yeah. That's how it started, just purely because a PE teacher said to me, "You should do this."
Yeah, 20 seconds and you're out. Any more than 20 seconds.
Oh, I used to get a rollicking because Tim was brilliant at his discipline and everything. Taught me everything, how to write voice pieces, I didn't know a thing. I was just on the, you know, with a phone. An ISDN box was a mystery to me, you know? Right. So, but because I was, you know, a rugby player and they wanted someone to do Moseley, I just got lucky. And that was 1997.
Wow.
So just how it started. So I was driving a van in the week and then going to do Moseley rugby on a Saturday afternoon. And that 50 quid was like gold dust.
Mark, I know you're a Yorkshire lad. You've never really, been anywhere else in terms of your base than Yorkshire, but where did it all start for you? Because the first time I met you, you were kind of working for TalkSport, but you were working for Yorkshire Radio as well at the time, I seem to remember.
Yeah, Radio Yorkshire, yeah, those were the days. Very similar story. No background in media or anything. Just over, I think, maybe 31, 32 years old. I went with a friend to watch, he used to film the Academy Rugby League games at Castleford, and we were going out for a beer after. So I said, I'll come to the game, we will go out for a beer after. And he sat there filming, there's no one, very few people there watching. And he said, oh, this is boring, just sat here on my own every week I have to do this. He said, I wish there was someone to commentate. And that's what. And I thought, I've always wanted to have a go at commentary. You couldn't make it up, mate, honestly, you couldn't make it up. He went, why don't you have a go? There's only me and you here. There's only me going to hear it. If it's rubbish, I'll just rub it off the thing when I edit it. I went, go on then, I'll have a go. So I had a go, and it was okay. But he put it on the website unbeknown to me, and they got a few comments. Oh, when did we start getting a commentary on the Academy games? And so then I got asked to do the Academy games, obviously free of charge.
What year was this?
Oh, I was 32, so 13 years ago. So, yeah, it's a bit early for me.
2008.
Yeah, about that time, mate. So basically, I started doing this, and I thought, hang on, I actually think I could do this. I think I could do it. So I wrote to James Dayton, who works at Radio Leeds. He still does. Just saying, can you give me some pointers? You know, he was the rugby league man in my part of the world, and I wanted it to be right. If we're going to do it, I wanted it to be right. And he invited me in to go watch a game with him at the end of 1 year, and then invited me if I'd like to do a trial game. So he sent me with an ICM box to a game, a testimonial game. And just said, dial in. And that, like Adam said, that was a nightmare. Just dialing the box in. That way, it was daunting at the time. He said, just commentate on the game. I'll put a line on you, record you and everything. And he basically just said, he rang me up the day after. He said, how do you think it went? I said, I think it went okay. And he said, Mark, it was really good. We'd like you to join the team. So, you know, I'm thinking, oh, great. I'll be doing reports on a Sunday at Batley or Dewsbury or something. And lo and behold, my media career is a whole host of sliding doors, and this is a sliding doors moment. My first game, I'm going to Hull Kingston Rovers on a Sunday afternoon in February, and everywhere I got up in the morning, it's snowing everywhere. I think, oh, the game's going to be off. But I set off on M62 down to one lane because there's snow everywhere, and I get there and I get a phone call off James, and he said, basically every other game is off, yours is the only game. So you're going to have to do full commentary. And I'm thinking, crap, I've never even been on the radio before. And now I'm doing full commentary. And the summariser turned up, Brad Drew in Australia. And he was like, oh, I've never done this before. He said, we'll be all right with you. I went, mate, I've never done it before either.
Oh my
so
God.
We had to do it. We had to do it. And we did it. And fortunately for us, Huddersfield, our team won, and they won quite well. So it was quite an easy commentary to ease us into it. But that's how it started for me. Just a complete random bit of luck, followed by another random bit of luck, and that's where we are.
Don't you think that we all benefit from coming into it late? I don't know about you, but I always felt like I was playing catch-up. So I worked really hard, I wanted to get better in my head. I never thought I was good enough.
I didn't start till I was, it didn't start for me till I was, 30. I was approaching my 30th birthday when it all kicked in for me. And, like I said, I've been a guitar salesman in a music shop, which is no grounding for sports commentary, other than it teaches you a few life lessons, I suppose, and a sort of a reality check, perhaps. What was your trademark? I mean, there's Adam, who was driving vans and whatnot.
Sales, just in sales, that's it. Just sales, office sales, on the phone, stuff like that. So I had a decent education, but never went to uni or anything. So I was pretty basic for me, muddling around, really, and just fell into it. And, it was just so lucky. I think whenever I speak to anyone, and everyone says, oh, you've got a great job, so lucky to be where I am at the minute.
But I think we all think that because we came into it late. I think we all know we're privileged. But it's funny, when people call me lucky, I always say, you know what, I've worked at a damn hard for 20 years to be lucky. It's not just luck. We all had to have the drive to change our careers when possibly we had families. It's a risk. You do something different, you don't know what's going to happen. And I think that's why when we go on the radio, we just love it, because we know our lives could have been so much different. We never had it mapped out for us like it was going to be.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I really enjoyed the life I had as a guitar salesman. There was very little money in it, as you know, guys, in sales. It's kind of hand to mouth as an existence, but it was still loads of fun, particularly, you know, when you think you're going to be a rock star anyway. You just think it's a means to an end. You think it's the, it's leading to, and of course, when it doesn't, you do have that kind of moment of clarity. Right, okay, I need a career here, not just a job. Something's got, and as luck would have it, my sliding doors moment came around that time with the chance to join BRMB. But you mentioned Tim Beach there, Adam, as your kind of mentor when WM came along and he started doing Moseley Rugby. Now, I remember Tim. I met him a number of times, and he was a pretty hands-on sports editor because he went out and about, and he was I met him at games a number of times working at Villa. So what did he get? I mean, was he hard? Was he tough on you, or was he just you know, someone that just guided you gently through your early years?
No, he was tough. He was tough on me, and he guided me. So it was sort of tough love, I guess. I literally, like Mark, knew nothing. You know, I turned up at WM. There were people who are still there, actually, who were sort of doing the job properly, daytime shifts, reading sports bulletins, doing everything. And I felt so out of my depth. You know, if you wouldn't know necessarily, Mark, but Pebble Mill was like, to go into Pebble Mill in Birmingham and see all the people that were on the telly on Midlands Today and everything, it was quite daunting, you know. And there was I, big, fat, overweight bloke who'd been running pubs and driving a van, suddenly, you know, walking past the presenters. And I felt really intimidated. And Tim would never give it me easy. So I was literally doing the match reports. And then Tim would say to me, well, what you need to do is that needs to be 40 seconds. Start with the score, end with the score. Do this, do that, halftime. So he taught me a structure to reporting. And then I was driving that lorry sort of thing for an engineering firm in the week. And eventually they offered me, there was a great shift dance that Simon Brotherton and other people have come through, the same thing, where we used to have a regional sport desk in the evening across the BBC. So I don't know if Mark knows this, but in Leeds, in Manchester, Birmingham, London, there was regional programming in the evening. So when you did this nighttime shift, it was a 4 p.m. to midnight. So I went through a period where I learned how to write CFAX sports pages, which we all love, the regional sport ones, the 390 pages from my memory. So the first thing they taught me was that evening shift. So I had to write the CFAX pages for 3 or 4 hours and learn how to write a story in 4 paragraphs, a top line, a headline. It had to fit into so many letters on your television screen, and then some quotes. And so I learned to write, and doing it on CFAX was great because you had to be concise. You couldn't just waffle and do
pages. It's kind of like early Twitter, isn't it, Adam? Because you've got 200 characters on Twitter, so you've had, you've got to go to, you don't want to have to do it on 2 pages, so you have to wait.
That's right, you can't. And so, unless it was a massive story, and then I was out of my depth anyway, because if it was a big story, I didn't know who to ring, who to call and everything. So there's all those aspects of the job people don't realise. I had no contacts. I had to ask people who I was working with and look stupid. And you have to look stupid to get on in the job, because unless you are, I say this to people now, and I'll say that to people I've trained, unless you ask, I can't help you and you can't improve. So you've got to be humble, haven't you? You've got to ask people and expose yourself to what you don't know. Otherwise, you just sit there saying, yes, I can do stuff, and make mistakes, and then they don't trust you. So it's an interesting one. And then the evening part of that dance, what was important was that it was a regional bulletin across Nottingham, you know, Leicester, Derby, Gloucester, Worcestershire, Warwickshire, Birmingham. It was a regional sport bulletin on the radio, 10:30 and 11:30 at night. So you had to suddenly learn how to understand what stories were important for a whole region, which was a really different way of thinking. I remember Tim rollocked me one night because I led a sport bulletin for the region with a Hensford Town game, because I was working for WM guys. So I thought it was quite big for Birmingham, but of course no one in Leicester would give a damn. And I led the whole regional bulletin with Hensford Town non-league football, and I got a rollicking. But it was a great, great education. And I had to freelance dance, as Mark would have done, I'm sure, and you, and make a decision. I was sort of driving this lorry 7 till 3, changing into a suit, rushing to Pebble Mill from Pershore, and then working 4 till 12 some nights to try and get started. And you have to do that for so long. And then at the end, you just have to give up the ghost and say, I'll take a punt because I'm so tired. I can't keep doing 2 jobs for more than a few months before I didn't see my kids for a week, you know? Yeah. That's how it was. That's just what you had to do to get on.
I kind of got lucky in that the first job I was offered was the Flying Eye, which was a daily thing. So, and the money I was being offered to do that was actually a little bit more than the money I was on as a guitar distributor at the time. So for me, my decision wasn't as difficult as it was for you as a freelancer, because you know, I'd got that kind of regular income coming in right from the get-go. What about you, Mark? I mean, you mentioned your mentor at Radio Leeds, who gave you that sort of kickstart. How tough was the love there?
No, it was good. It was fantastic. And we still get on really well to this day, you know. And I am thankful. Anyone that ever asked, I always say it was him who got me into it. But it, again, just a series of things that happened that led to me probably being in the position that Adam was in. One of my colleagues at Radio York was taken ill. He did the rugby league on a Sunday. They were looking for someone. He actually knew my father, and he said to my dad, would I be interested in covering for him while he was ill? So I went and did the Radio York thing with a blessing of Radio Leeds. So I was doing a game Radio Leeds on a Friday and then doing Radio York on a Sunday. But that allowed me to present doing the rugby. So that was another little learning curve. And from there, I mean, this is how random my career is. You know, there's a guy who lives in Wigan, Chris Milo, worked Wish FM, Wire FM. Were part of the TalkSport family, weren't they, in the day. His mum lived in York, and he used to go see her on a Sunday. He'd be listening to the rugby as he's driving home. And all of a sudden, Chris got the rights to do St Helens and Wigan Rugby League commentary. And he thought, hang on, I've listened to this guy on the radio. I'll give him a ring. So all of a sudden, I get an offer to go, would you like to do our rugby? I'm like, yeah, too right, I would. I'd love to do it. Went and did it. And as I went in the meeting, coming out, he said, by the way, you don't do football, do you? I went, well, yeah, I do, actually, yeah. He goes, oh, we need a Bolton Wanderers commentator. Could you do that? And all of a sudden, from doing one game a week, I've got a game where I'm doing football on a Saturday and rugby maybe Friday and Sunday as well. And all of a sudden, then you've got a bit of a decision to make, because I had a full-time job. And it just builds up and builds up. And I think, like Adam, I found myself at one point working 80, 90 hours a week and thinking, this can't carry on. I've got to make the decision. And I opted in the end to go down the broadcasting route. And thankfully, I'm still here.
How tough a decision was it?
Oh, massive, mate. Massive. Because I'm not going to lie, I wasn't in a great position financially at the time. You know, it was a bit of a gamble. But the work seemed to be coming, and it was one of them. Because you've got that regular with a Bolton gig, that guaranteed you 50 games a season. You've got the rugby thing. All of a sudden, you have got an income. You think, if I can just get one more gig somewhere else, and I managed to pick that up, all of a sudden, the decision became quite easy. But at the time, it was a big thing, mate. It was a worrying thing. And, you know, the backing of your family counts a lot. You know, you just got to follow your... got to work hard and go for it, I think. And that's what I'd say to anyone. A lot of it is the stuff you do in the early years leads to what happens later on. You know, like Adam said, we all think we're lucky, but it's not luck. It's hard work. It's good. I remember got a Harrogate on, covering a Harrogate Town game when Harrogate were way down the pyramid and they were losing 5-0 away from home. It was like 2.5 hour drive away from home. I had to wait an hour for Simon Weaver to finish his rant in the dressing room after. And I said, can I go home? I need to go. It's like a 2.5 hour journey. I went, no, we've got to have reaction from the manager. And I'm like, oh, wow. And I'm thinking, in all honesty, they've lost 5-0. Who's bothered what Simon Weaver's got to say tonight? But I did. I had to wait. And it's like, it's those moments, isn't it? That's where you learn. Certainly for us that are not taught, that's where you learn your trade. And you just, great moments when you look back. But at the time, you think, wow, what am I doing here?
We say yes to everything, don't we?
That's what we say to
people. Say yes, because then they'll ask you again. If you say no to a couple of gigs, they'll ask someone else and you'll never get another chance.
The glamour of post-match hangarounds waiting for a manager who may or may not appear, because there could have been every chance, Mark, that night that Simon Weaver may have sacked it all off and said, I'm not speaking to anybody.
Exactly. You know what the beauty was is I was lit because it was non-league football. I was sat right outside the dressing room and you could hear him, and he was going mad. And there was a lull and you think, right, I'm going to knock on the door. And I walked up to the door and he started again. And he was like, oh no, I just had to wait. And you know what, he came out and he was like, oh yeah, no problem, mate. Yeah, and he was great. He gave me a great interview and I thought, fair play to you.
Scariest part of the job, isn't it, when you're a rookie? Dealing with managers after games in any sport, it's the scariest part of the job, because if they want to take it out on you and you haven't got much experience, you can crumble so easily. And it is the toughest bit. Dennis Smith did it to me, Dance.
Oh, yeah.
I was a rookie at WM. Pre-season friendly, Mark. How about that? He had a pop at me after a West Brom pre-season friendly. And he just, in the way Gordon Strachan used to do down here when he was Southampton manager, just wanted to belittle me because I was a bit out of my depth. rather than answer the questions. You know, and I'll never forget it. I've never forgotten it, how Dennis Smith treated me. And interestingly, this week, I also never forgot how Steve Bruce treated me when he was Birmingham manager and I was a rookie dance, because he was as good as gold. He was really nice to me and didn't give me any trouble, was warm. And it might have been my first Birmingham game. I don't know. It was just, I was felt like out of my depth again. And I just remember those two situations. Trevor Francis was good to me. But, you know, just dealing with managers was the scariest bit of the job when you're young, because you've got other journalists around you as well sometimes. And you feel like you might have really experienced newspaper journalists standing next to you while you're doing the questions, writing notes. And you just feel so much pressure.
Well, Ray Graydon was the first manager I ever had to deal with at Walsall. And back in those days, 99, when I did my first report, he had a thing with his players where none of his Walsall players were allowed to have mobile phones on match days. And they all had to have short hair. They all had to have short back and sides. Although I think one player, Zigo Arinaldi, got away with it, probably because they paid him decent money to come over from Spain. But all the players had to have short hair. I'm sure Jimmy Walker, one of my pals, would corroborate this. So I come down to get the exclusive team news, as I've been asked to do by Tom Ross off for Ray Graydon for a 2 o'clock start. And I'm there with my big Brian May, you know, hair underneath a ill-fitting bobble hat. I mean, Ray Graydon, he teased me, but in a nice way. I mean, it was frightening in a way, but also it made me think, right, I could have a relationship with this fella, because he didn't cut you dead. All right, he took the mickey a little bit out of the way I look compared to how he wanted his players to look. But yes, you're right. That there was a terrifying, that thing of holding the mic. Darren Fletcher talked about that on the last episode, talking to Brian Clough, and the microphone shaking that much. You can hear the sound of the mic shaking whilst you're trying to get answers out of somebody that you're utterly bricking it about meeting. Wilshire must have had that.
We must have bumped into each other, Dance, before we knew it, because I covered Walsall when Gray Graydon was manager. And one game up at Burnley, they turned all the lights off after the interview. Came up to the top of the back of that main stand at Burnley, guys, which you'll know is
a long way up.
Did the interview. And as we were going back underneath the stand to go out, the lights went out. So Ray Graydon, and I look, because I'm a Villa fan, I love Ray Graydon, because he, you know, my first memories as a child was him scoring in the 75 League Cup final. And of course, he worked with my oppo, Dave Merrington, at Saints for a few years. So, but he basically held on to my jacket and followed me out of the stadium like a conga going out of Burnley. But you know that thing about when you learn through those experiences of how to deal with managers. I'll never forget Alan Pardew, manager of Southampton, when they were the Phoenix from the Flames in League One, when they got the new owners 10 years ago. And he was having a to do with the chairman at the time. I think they'd drawn a game, and he'd obviously not seen eye to eye with the chairman, Nicola Cortese, who we all know was an interesting character, and Pardew the same. And I got on fine with Alan, and then they played Huddersfield at home, I think, won 4 or 5-0 the game after in a midweek. And I thought, well, this will be easy. You know what it's like, chaps, when the team's won, you think, right, this will be a doddle. Lovely post-match interview, no problem. And I'm in the tunnel at St. Mary's, and I go, Alan, you must be delighted, a great win and a really good performance, whatever. He goes, yep. I thought, oh God, where's this going? And he was angry, didn't want to say anything, because the chairman had criticised the 0-0 draw at Wickham, I think, the match before. So he was in a bad mood, but taking it out on me. But luckily, after doing it for a number of years, I wasn't intimidated. And it was one of those moments I haven't forgotten, even though it was a decade ago, because I remember he answered 5 questions with like 1 or 2 word answers. And then I said to him, Alan, is there anything else you want to say to the fans who are driving out of the game tonight on their way back after that 5-0 win? And he suddenly clicked in his head, you know, we're just the conduit. There's no point in taking it out on us. You know, it's actually the fans listening in their cars coming out of the game who are listening to you. And then he gave me a long answer. And I just thought, I feel better now. That's like from Dennis Smith to Alan Pardew is like a world apart from that sort of like 12-year difference.
Go on, Will, so have you got one? Well, in terms of your post-match interview travails, was anybody particularly tough in those early years?
Well, yeah, I'll give you Brian McDermott. You may know him. Leeds Rhinos' most successful coach in Super League, former Royal Marine, and he's not a guy to be messed with. I tell you, he's not a guy to be messed with. One of my first games, they'd played pretty poorly but won the game. And I went up to him after. I said, well, not, you know, obviously you've got the result. He went, yeah, but it's all about how we play. It's all about how we play. I'm not bothered about the result. And then the week after, they went away from home, but they played really well and lost. I said, well, not the result you wanted, but you got the performance. Oh, no, it's all about the result. And I thought, hang on. He's winding me up here. He said the exact opposite last week, and he's gone the opposite way this week. And I just thought, it was him just testing me. He don't suffer fools. He wants you to challenge him. And I won't say good friend. I don't think anyone's good friends with Brian, but I've got to know him really well since then. And he just says, like, I just want to be challenged. I don't want people asking me mundane questions. And it was just like, he knocked me off my guard. And he's such an intimidating guy. I mean, 6'4", 5", you know, built like a Marine even now. You just didn't mess with a guy. And you didn't want to fall out with him. I've seen him fall out with journalists. And it's like, it's not pretty. So that was an early tester. And I think, like you said, like, you know, again, like Adam said, you just got to think on your feet, haven't you? And try and get, it's not you that they're speaking to, it's the listeners. I think you've got to remember that sometimes and not be put off when maybe you get an answer that knocks you back a little bit. But he was certainly the first one.
Well, I thought you the bloke that managed Reading.
Oh, yeah, old Leeds, because he was at Leeds for about 10 minutes as well, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Not that Brian McDermott,
no. He wasn't too intimidating.
No, he wasn't.
He was a joy by comparison, that Brian McDermott, I'm sure, if we're going to do like for like. So you mentioned rugby league commentary, Mark. And funnily enough, when you mentioned Castleford a little earlier, it took my mind to Mick Morgan's commentary, I Can't Spake, when Cass were playing, was it Wigan?
It was, mate, and
there was a dirty Campbell should have walked for a punch on a player and he only got a yellow card. But the art of rugby league commentary, just give us the differences between being a rugby league commentator one day when you're doing St Helens Wigan and then you're off to watch Leeds playing football on a Saturday.
Yeah, look, I think those that have watched rugby league, it's quite a quick game, it's quite intense, and obviously if you can't see what's going on at home, you need to know what's going on, you know, and I think one of the best things anyone's ever said to me is, you make me feel like I'm at the game, you know, and I think, wow, I've done my job. If that's how I can make someone at home listening feel, and just try and get across the excitement. I sometimes wonder, do I get a little bit too excited, but it's such action-packed, and I'm lucky in rugby league is that even if it's a really poor game, there's always something happening. There might be a big tackle or a high tackle or a dirty tackle, something like that, or a great try. There's always something to talk about. You don't really get your nil-nil at football where there's not been a shot at goal and literally you're padding for 90 minutes trying to, you know, keep the listener tuned in, if you like. So,
well, one of those semi-finals in the Super League this year, was it the game at the DW, wasn't there? That would have been a tough commentary gig.
Yeah, it was, because it was 8-0, and I don't think Wigan had scored even if Leeds had gone home at half time. So it's just one of them things. You know, you just got to. I think what you've got to be, you've got to be honest. And if it's not great, I think sometimes you've got to say it's not great, and you can't fluff it up. And you've just got to be, you know, you've got to be realistic with your commentary. I had one when I was at Bolton, lost 7-1 at Reading, I think, just going off topic. And it was the really early days of Twitter. And one woman tweeted in, listening at home, said, I think Mark's been overly negative about Bolton, right? And they scored with the last kick of the game, Bolton. If it had been 12-0, no one could have complained, honestly. And she says, oh, I think you've been really negative. And then one guy came out of the ground, must have seen the tweet, and said, if he said anything positive about that game, I want him sacked. And you think, there you go. In two tweets, you can't win. You cannot win. Someone says I'm being too negative. Someone says I can't say anything positive. So you've got to be honest, haven't you? You've got to call it as you see it, but be honest and fair. I think
And honest to yourself.
Fair. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because especially when you're doing it the same team week in, week out, you're the eyes of the person listening at home that can't go to the game. It's amazing how you'll see on social media, oh, so-and-so played well. They haven't even been to the game. They're judging it on what you've how you've called the game. You know,
they're not stupid, are they? Fans aren't stupid.
No, they're not. And I think if they can trust you, then you're winning. I think you're winning straight away.
Yeah, but he's right about rugby. I mean, my reputation in the BBC grew dance because I spent 4.5 years with Northampton Saints.
Yeah.
And I arrived there just at the time when they'd been taken over by Keith Barwell. They had Matt Dawson and Paul Grayson and Pat Lamb, and they had this amazing Tim Rodber, and they had this amazing team. And they were, within 9 months of being there, they'd won the European Cup. I'd been all over Europe. I'd never done a commentary before I got there in rugby, but the rugby games have more facets to them. Let's be honest, guys, if you're watching Manchester City, it can be pretty dull to commentate on because they keep the ball so much and especially happy just to pass it along the centre-backs and the full-backs. And actually, with rugby, you get the line-outs, the scrums, the mauls, the rucks, the facets of play, the backs, the forwards. There is more to talk about, I think, around those games in both rugby codes when it isn't a good game. You know, whereas in football, if it's 3-0 at half-time to Man City, you might as well pack up and go home. You know, and what are you going to say? Because they've got the ball for 75% of the match, you know, and you talk around the game and then someone says, you're not telling us where the ball is. And I think, because it's not doing anything, I'd rather try and say something interesting about a Saints player or a City player because they're just passing it, you know. Yeah, how easy is it, Dan? You can just go Walker to Diaz to look to Diaz to walk. And you don't want to do that. It's boring commentary. So you've got to try and invent things to actually keep it interesting or talk about something. Whereas in rugby, at least you very rarely do you get that. You know, you don't get that many blowouts like that at the top level because they're tightly contested matches. And even if they're poor and there's a lot of mistakes, there's got all those different areas you can discuss. In my opinion.
I don't know how you two commentate on scrums. Scrums in rugby league, I don't know why they bother, Mark.
They haven't done for the last 18 months, thankfully, but they're bringing them back next year. But look, scrum in rugby league lasts about 5 seconds, and we all know it's going in the back row anyway. So it literally, you don't even have to talk about the scrum, whereas in union, it's a massive part of the game, you know, and it can take a couple of minutes to resolve. So slightly different there, but...
Union has changed, Adam. Even in union, it appears to be a much more... Well, I hated playing rugby at school. Right, hated it because they put me in the middle of the front row. And the legend Les Ross always he told me because I told him the story and he said had to do the same thing at school and he said he was going to call his autobiography "I Was a Teenage Hooker" and I thought that was the road. But I hated it. But in those days at school, there was a genuine contest for the ball in a scrum. It's not a genuine contest anymore, is it? So there's no point in commentating on that either, is there?
Well, the safety conscious element of it, Mark will know. I mean, I get frustrated watching union now, you know, crouch, touch, hold, engage. But I mean, blimey, I used to love being a prop forward because you could just, that's when you enjoyed yourself, you know. But I do get what you said. It's much more sanitized than it was. But the other point is, and Mark will know this, you're talking about the scrums dance, you know, it's a world of its own, especially in union. And I might have been a prop, but as a commentator, I couldn't tell necessarily who was making the scrum go wrong or if a referee gives a penalty, how does he spot who's wrong? But having a good summariser, I used to have Martin Bayfield with me. I started his broadcasting career doing matches with me at Northampton. And, you know, he would be able to know. So having a good summariser is everything that you can bounce off because I always say to summarisers, I say what happens and you say why. That's what you should be there for. Yeah. You know, so if you've got a good summariser, it makes a world of difference, especially in the rugby codes where they know the insides of the game and they can really get that knowledge out and that inside knowledge.
Well, Adam, we'll get to how you ended up on the South Coast and becoming sports editor in a little while, but I want to come back to you, Mark, because obviously you've now, as we were talking about, you developed these roles where you know Bolton and there's a bit of St Helens and a bit of Wigan and there's still a bit of Leeds and York. So how did Radio Yorkshire come into the picture?
Well, Ken Bates owned Leeds United and he owned Yorkshire Radio. And then obviously when he sold the club, he wanted to keep the Yorkshire Radio element part of it. Now, in the end, he had a very expensive court case with Leeds United with JFH and they fell out and everything. But part of his settlement was he set up his own radio station right outside, over the road, 20 yards from Ellen Road.
Yeah, just over the subway.
Yeah, exactly, over the subway. And he got the rights. He got, I think it was 5 years or 4 year deal to broadcast on Leeds United. So there, he was setting up his own station. A couple of the guys that I knew who works at the old station, he asked them to go back. They weren't so keen. I think they'd been bitten and moved on and were looking at other things. And one of them rang me and said, look, they're looking to do it. They're going to get the Leeds United gig. They're going to get some rugby league rights. Would you be interested? And I went, I saw the guys and got involved there. And that was such a unique situation because it was a station setting up from absolutely nothing. And it was a bit of a blank canvas. And I think had they had done it again and I think the guy that set it up probably didn't do it quite so well. And a guy called Sam Bridges came in after that. And he was getting it right. we were becoming, well, because obviously anything to do with Ken Bates, instantly the Leeds fans hated it. They didn't want to listen. You know, they hated Ken Bates. They'd still hate him. You know what I mean? It's one of them. So it was quite a tricky gig, really, because you're in the ground, you're covering it. But it's amazing how many people, don't listen to that Bates stuff. But yet they listen, you know, and you're getting feedback on Twitter and stuff like that. And we built it up. We started doing shows around the games and everything. And we worked with a club. The club were pretty good to us, to be fair. Although I think they had to be, given that Bates had a bit of a hold over them with a court case. But that's how it all really kicked off at Leeds. And we were doing a couple of rugby league games a week. We were doing a Leeds United every game, home and away. So that was fantastic, really. That was Leeds is a massive club. There's great interest in it, you know, all over, really. So that was a superb opportunity, one I'm really grateful for. We worked really hard. And I think whilst the station went, when Ken eventually pulled the plug, we all knew it was a vanity project. It was a two fingers up at Leeds United rather than I want to set up this, you know, record-breaking radio station. So we all knew one day the plug would get pulled, and it did. But what I'd like to say is I think pretty much everyone that worked there has gone on to bigger and better things. So it was a great breeding ground. And what I would say as well, a couple of the kids that came in on work experience, they went on, to massive things, and they came in working for free, learning the trade, asking the questions, picked up a show when someone didn't turn in. That's how, you know, and it just gone from there, and it's been great to watch them build. And again, it's not, you work hard, you get lucky in this business, I think.
Who are we talking about there, Mark? Can we name names at this point?
I think Danny Parkinson, he works for the BFBS. He's done a show on Radio 1. I think he did the breakfast show on Radio 1. You know, he came in as a would-be tech op. You know what I mean? And now he's doing so well for himself. He works all around the world with the Armed Forces Radio, and I'm sure he'll got bigger and better things. He was named one of the top 30 in the, I forget what the awards are, but he got one of the top 30 to look out for under 30 years of age. And, you know, it's a privilege to work with guys like that and see him develop. It really is.
So, Adam, the South Coast obviously beckoned at some point, because you mentioned you worked in Northampton with BBC Radio Northampton. How did the opportunity to go to the South Coast come about?
I went for the job twice, actually. First time I didn't get it. The guy who got it, Mark DeMuth, has been in charge of ITV football, I think, since he left Solent years ago. He's very high up in TV football. He's a terrific operator. He got it the first time. And he went off to back to television, and it came up again. But I have no association previously to this area of the world, apart from, you love this, talk about our three lives being all chance and various things. My parents had a caravan at near Highcliffe, near New Milton on the south coast. They bought a static caravan for their holidays years ago. So when my kids were younger, we used to go and use the static caravan when we could and give them a holiday, you know, because I never had any money to take the four kids anywhere, for goodness sake. So, you know, it was a godsend. So there I was down at New Milton, Highcliffe, enjoying the holiday. And there was a charity football match at New Milton Football Club, and some of the guys from BBC Radio Solent were playing in it. You had, like, you know, usual Strachan was playing, Letitia, right, all these people, ex-Saints players. It was a charity thing. But Tony Husband, who is now working with the MLS in Nashville, commentating and doing TV for them, who was long time down here on the South Coast, my Saints commentator predecessor, and Kevin James and a few other people I met who were working for Solent, I went to watch the game, and then they sort of got chatting to them. I thought, nice people. And then the job came up, and I thought, all right, I'll go for it. It's a nice part of the world. And it was purely, I think if my parents hadn't had a caravan down here, I'd never have thought to move down here, but I knew what a lovely part of the world it was. And when the opportunity came around the second time, I got the job. But you know what, guys? I didn't get the job. They gave it to somebody who'd been in commercial radio, who turned it down. And they had to come back to me grovelling, saying, will you take it, having told me I hadn't got it. So actually,
kind of David Brent. It's, yeah. The other guy failed the medical.
I got it. So I was really lucky. And I'm so glad I did, because it's for my kids to grow up down by the seaside and everything else. It's been great, even if it's more expensive to live down here.
Well, yeah, but you are sports editor there. Let's remind everybody of that, because your remit is not only Southampton, no. But you have to make sure that Portsmouth are well served, Bournemouth, of course, and Hampshire County Cricket Club as well, because that's a big part of your remit too.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because you know, people outside the area, Solent means nothing. So it sometimes annoys me that it's called Solent, because if I said to someone in Yorkshire, Mark, where's the Solent? They'd probably go, you know, in space somewhere or something. Why would they know? The Solent's just a bit of sea between the Isle of Wight and Portsmouth and Southampton. But the fact is, it's one of the larger radio stations in local radio, because it's Hampshire, Dorset and the Isle of Wight. So I'm lucky because I have more than one transmitter, because it's a big radio station. So on Saturday afternoons, we split our radio frequencies across the three teams. So at some parts of the patch, you could actually try and get all three commentaries if you were lucky. So we do every Bournemouth game, every Portsmouth game, every Southampton game, every Hampshire cricket game, and anything else that comes along. And so it's nice for us because we've got three commentary rights for three clubs. And of course, the up and downs we've had down here since I arrived, I mean, I've been very fortunate. It's never been dull, whether it's Bournemouth's rise from minus 17 or Southampton dropping out of the Premier League, like Pompey, their financial collapse, Harry Redknapp moving clubs from the South Coast from one to the other and back. I mean, FA Cup finals, FA Cup win. I've been lucky. You know, some people live and work in their patches for years and never get those sort of things. So I've just been fortunate that when I landed, it all sort of kicked off. And we've been lucky. You know, we get the rights. And yes, so most of the job is being the manager of the team and organising ourselves and producing our shows and presenting shows on Cherries and Pompey. But, you know, I've commentated on all three over the years many times. But actually, the Saturday is the icing on the cake. You can put up with a bad week if you get into a game on a Saturday and commentating. That's what it is for me. It's the icing on the cake. And that passion is what drives you the rest of the week.
But Southampton is obviously the club that you gravitate towards for commentaries and have done for some years now. And we talk about, you know, the quality of the summariser that works with you. Dave Merrington has been your long-time partner. Is this his last season? Is he?
We announced his retirement at the end of this season back in the summer, and the reaction was huge. You know, what people don't realise about Dave Merrington, they might think, oh, he was manager of Southampton for 1 year. You know, that's what some people might remember, if that. But Dave is one of the finest coaches, and as a young coach was brilliant. This is a man that took Bristol City to the FA Cup youth final when he was hired by John Sillett, I think, down there many moons ago. He was then offered jobs by Bobby Robson, Don Revy, various people. He could have gone to Ipswich. He could have gone to Leeds. He could have gone, Jimmy Adamson, he went with in the end, his former Burnley boss. But he's just a great coach. And even though he's in his 70s, he's remained relevant. And that's the biggest compliment I can give him, is that his passion for the sport and his understanding of players. You know, and we, all this stuff we hear, boys, I don't know about you, I've never used the phrase low block in my life, okay? That's just defending deep, you know? And at the end of the day, the game doesn't change. And if Dave can get he can see that what's going on tactically, he can see players when they're in the wrong shape, when their shoulders, when they're square, all that stuff that I can't follow because I'm watching the ball, Dave's brilliant at, and that's what makes him such a genius. I personally think, and I'm biased, yes, but I think there is no better summariser in the game, because he doesn't miss a thing, and he calls it and he anticipates what's going on, and he'll say things that then happen.
If I'm sat with you at St Mary's and I'm working there for Talk Sport, and you're the row behind me, just to my right, there's Dave, and I see the respect he commands from ex-players who come from, you know, away sides. Yeah. Who will see him, yes, and they gravitate towards Dave straight away to go and say hello. So Tony DiRigo comes up the stairs. He sees Dave. He goes to say hello. Perry Groves, who works with me, always makes sure he has time to have a chat with Dave because, you know.
You're right. There are some others as well, by the way. You know, Chris Wilder sent someone up at Sheffield United last season to get Dave's phone number so Chris could ring Dave for advice.
Wow.
Chris Wilder, you know. He has that with Phil Parkinson's a protege of his. There are a few managers now who will, if they're having a bad time, will call Dave, and he's brilliant at just giving them guidance and helping them with things that might be going wrong and talking them through it, because he's a great wise man. And, you know, you talk about the obvious Letitiae. Alan Shearer only made the Southampton first team because Dave pushed Chris Nicol to put him in it. Chris Nicol refused for 6 weeks. When he put him in, Shearer scored a hat-trick against Arsenal on his debut at 17, all right? And then Chris Nicol came back to Dave and went, oh, you were right. And he went, I've been telling you, Chris. I've been telling you for weeks. So, you know, Shearer. But then you talk about players, Dance, Mark, that you would know from other clubs that you wouldn't know. And like you said, Jason Roberts, when he was a young player at Wolves, they didn't want him, but Dave took him to one side. They were just trying to build him up and get him in the weights. And Dave said, no, he's a player. Get him on the football pitch, teach him. And his career, he puts down a lot to Dave. Alan Smith, George Graham took Dave to Leeds. And he had that young squad, which included Alan Smith, Jonathan Woodgate and so on, as the under-21s. Dave was coaching them. And of course, when George Graham left, unfortunately, David O'Leary wanted to go another way. But the fact is, I went to MK Dons a few years ago for the League Cup tie, looked down at the side of the pitch, Alan Smith and Dave are nattering for half an hour. But Dave was tough on Alan Smith. Made him do runs, made him do stuff because he was ill-disciplined. You know, I've got great stories from the car journeys of all Dave's clubs, whether it's Leeds, Sunderland, Burnley, Wolves, whatever. Lee Hughes was a player he spotted and Wolves didn't take him on, Dance. And then West Brom did. And Dave got rolloped. The board hauled Dave in because he was chief scout, whatever, and said, why didn't we get Lee Hughes at Wolves? And he said, I told the manager to get Lee Hughes, but he never went to watch him play. Oh, right. Sorry, Dave. The things like that, you see. Yeah. A lot of players that he's influenced. And I love him for that. But it just goes to show what a good man he is, really. What a good football man he is.
Well, when that last game comes, that'll be a very sad day.
Very hard for me. He's like a second dad.
Yeah, I can appreciate that, Adam. Absolutely. Mark, if I come back to you, I'm your TalkSport colleague now. Mm. When did the TalkSport link come in? How did you get involved with us?
Going back a few years now, obviously, as we mentioned earlier, Wish FM, Wire FM were part of the TalkSport family. Villa Matt, am I allowed to? Villa Matt.
Villa Matt.
I got in touch with Villa Matt. I don't know how I got his number, but basically chasing him up about doing some rugby league. And eventually he relented, and I did a couple of the cup semi-finals. And then Matt moved on and had to get back in, if you like. Kept asking, and eventually TalkSport started doing a little bit of rugby league, just for the main, you know, around the main game. So I did that. And I always kept in touch with Mike Boville, kept pestering Mike, and then all of a sudden TalkSport 2 comes along. They need a bit of content, and really, you know, he rang me, and that was my big way in, if you like. Got in that way, and obviously once Radio Yorkshire knew that was on the way out, I spoke to Mike about doing a little bit of football, became part of Around the Grounds on a Saturday. Which is, you know, Adam mentioned earlier about Saturdays. That's one of the best gigs in the business. You got a gig on a Saturday on national radio, you're doing pretty well. And I'm thankful I'm involved with that. So that's how it all started and just built up from there, really. And, you know, rugby league and a little bit of darts through yourself. And, you know, it just builds up nicely.
Darts has been great fun, hasn't it? I mean, you and I have worked together at World Championships and World Match Plays. And there's it's a totally different aesthetic as a commentator to doing football or indeed rugby league, I should imagine.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I worked, as I went through, I got a gig during the week working with William Hill on their sports betting radio station. And that's where you'd obviously explain what's going on and talking around the betting. And we did quite a lot of darts because a lot of people like to have a bet on the darts. So I knew darts on the radio would work even before, you know, before we started doing it properly, full time, if you like. So I was quite excited to get to be a part of it. I knew it would work. I've listened to you guys doing it the year before. I just think the drama of it, you know, the background sounds of the dart hitting the ball, because we're lucky we get the feed and the groan of the crowd or the cheer of the crowd. It is absolutely brilliant. And people go, darts on radio, how does that work? It really does work. I think it's everything the radio is about. You know, the sounds of what's going on around you, the joy and the excitement, the disappointment. I thought that was one of the big things we missed in live sport, is not the cheering, the groaning when something didn't quite happen. You know, the pressure of the crowd when a pass gets misplaced or a double gets missed or whatever.
Jason Cundy always bangs on about, and I love Jason dearly, but you always say darts isn't a sport. I'm sorry, when it's down to two dart players at a world championship, it's three sets apiece, it's the first of four sets, and they're both stuck on double one and they can't hit it. And the sheer gut wrench of everybody concerned, not just the two players, but that the audience, they are just hooked on every dart. And us as commentators, it's the chaos theory, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I always think it's better. The sport of darts is better when they do miss, because that's when the real drama comes in. Look, we admire the nine darters and the 170 finishes. You think, bloody hell, these guys are good. But it's when I always think snooker, darts, golf, you've got to have the bottle to win the game. And it's having that bottle when it counts. That's what I admire about these guys, that they can do it. But we've seen some crackers. We've seen some shockers. For me, it's the shockers that are the best ones, because they just, the atmosphere of the crowd goes through the roof, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's wonderful tension. Are there any other sports that you've turned your hand to, Adam, aside from football and rugby? And you mentioned you've done some cricket as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I did quite a lot of cricket. But I did one boxing night, when there was a Northampton boxer who was boxing for a British title, I think. And it just so happened that I think the guy who was running the British Council of Boxing, whatever it's called, the British Boxing Board Council, whatever it's called, he John Smith, I think his name was, he actually got in touch with me and he said he'd be my summariser. So I ended up going. And I have to tell you, of course, I could have done some more. That was some experience ringside. It's the only time I've ever been ringside in my life. And the difference between watching boxing on the telly and watching it at the side of the ring is frightening. I mean,
it's a bit more brutal, isn't it, when you sat 6 feet away?
You don't see the redness of the skin on the telly. You know, you might see the obvious cut, but you don't see the pounding like it is physically next to you and the bits of blood that you get on the canvas and everything. It's just like a Rocky film, you know. It was brilliant, but the buzz I got from commentating on it, because I obviously loved watching it and so on, so I knew the words. That's half the thing, isn't it, guys? You know about rugby league, Mark, the language. If you know the sport, you've got the language. You can't fool listeners. If you don't know the right phrases for the right bits of the game, you're in trouble. So, you know, I knew enough and had this very experienced guy next to me, but I would love to have done some more boxing, you know. So that was something I did as a one-off. So, no, it's mostly football. I regret we don't have a good rugby team down here in the patch. That's a big regret. We, you know, this whole area is massive and it's not that far from London. We haven't got a good rugby side. But, you know, that's a regret. But you can't do everything, can you?
No.
It's not like Northampton when I was doing Rushden and Diamonds, Northampton Town and the Saints all in the same time on my own. That was the best learning curve ever, just being a one-man band going up and down the country. But, you know.
Rushden and Diamonds, there's a
story.
Yeah, that one hell of a story of the rise and fall. Goodness me.
What a time as well. I was so lucky. Like I said, everything's been timing, like for Mark, you know, Ted Bates things comes along just at the right time. Yeah, it's all in the timing. You just get lucky. But they went up from whatever league they were in. They had the money from the Dr. Martin's owner, Max Griggs, who was a lovely man. And of course, dealing with Brian Talbot was fun week in, week out, because he was another manager who was pugnacious. So you had to, you know, like Mark said, it's better when the manager's robust, when you can challenge him and he doesn't mind. And you can have almost an argument, and even off air, you can discuss it and debate stuff. That's what I love, when you get that time with the managers and players away from the microphone, which we've missed in COVID, and I've missed post-COVID, because you can't build relationships. But that Rushden story was quite something, you know, and you know, doing them in a playoff final at Cardiff, you know, you think, what is going on? It was crazy. It was crazy. So I've been lucky. Like I said, there's been good stories in the time of when I've gone to different radio stations. It's sort of been just happened like that. So, yeah, very privileged.
It's funny, you talk about the boxing. I've never been to a boxing, a bit of amateur boxing, maybe a sports dinner, I think, it is, but nothing any more than that. But I was in TalkSport the other day, and the engineer, Adam Reed, who I've got to know very well, he was in Vegas for the trilogy, the Deontay Wilder. And I said, what was it like, you know, being, because of course they're two rows from the ring apron. And I said, could you feel the sweat flying? He said, funnily enough, yeah, you could, you could feel that when the punches land and the sweat flies off Wilder's brow or off Fury's head, it gets to the first two rows.
I can vouch for that, Dan. I mean, my friend at school, he was a boxing world champion, and we went ringside. I went to watch him once. He knocks a guy out in 40 seconds. I'm thinking, hang on, I've paid 90 quid a seat to sit here for 90 seconds. And then I went and watched him, and he got dismantled in the ring, and it was the worst thing I've ever watched. It was horrible. But we were sat right at the front, two heavyweights on the ropes in front of you, and I'm sat there, and literally the sweat comes on you. It's like it's barbaric when you're there. As I said, compared to watching it on the telly, you're in a different world.
Yeah, your respect for them goes up massively, doesn't it?
Because anyone that gets in a ring, absolute respect, yeah. But you mentioned that Fury fight. I was in the airport. I'd been away and I was coming back. I listened to it live on TalkSport. The coverage was absolutely brilliant. It really was. It felt like you were there. What a fight that was. But yeah, again, that's the art of it, making the listener feel like you sat there, what you can see it. You know, Mike Costello, I've watched loads of fights at home. TV off, curtain shut, lights off, and it felt like you were there because he's that good at what he does. And I think boxing's a great sport for the radio as well.
Yeah, I think DAZN have got themselves one hell of a capture getting Mike signed up for what's to come with their service. And the industry landscape is changing, gents. I mean, DAZN and streaming, you get the feeling that there's something in the works. I don't know whether it's going to affect radio that much and what we do, but certainly in terms of the way that we view sport and where commentators go, I think we're in for a very interesting next 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, I think if the Premier League gets fragmented with the broadcasting rights and the clubs go their own way, that'll be the biggest change, won't it? If the clubs take control of their own deals, that's going to be the biggest change we'll see. And whether that's good for the league or bad for the Premier League, I don't know, but it could change the landscape, especially for television, hugely. And it might change the landscape for radio as well, Dan. So I know you said it might not, but what if the clubs decide to do everything themselves?
Well, we're already in the era, of course, where we feel as broadcasters, and you mentioned it about 5 minutes ago, Adam, that we don't get the access that we used to managers and players. And of course, clubs have their own websites. You do with Southampton a lot, and they appear, football clubs, now to be, I don't know what the right word is, mistrustful or just wary of us, in the sense that they feel that we're always going to, we're out to get them or something.
It's an unfounded paranoia, because actually I've always had good relationships with all managers and players, and actually that's the part of my job I enjoy the most, is a relationship building. And of course, when you're working with one club for years, you have to have that, from the people on the door to the media staff to the chairman to the chief exec. That's a big part of your job, is to have a good relationship with your clubs at all levels. And it's just that they will refuse things for the sake of it sometimes, even if you know you're not going to try. I'm not a tabloid newspaper, I'm not going to try and trip them up. It's not my gig, because I need to be there the week after and the week after and the week after. And I need to make sure my relationship's good. So I get good access, and I always have had similar access. I mean, my point, Dance, was more about post-COVID, how things haven't changed.
Oh, right.
I can't get my pre-match interview with the manager on Zoom. It's part of a press conference. It used to be a one-to-one at the training ground. And then you're hanging around there and you're speaking to players and you're learning things. Or you can ask the manager why he did certain things off air. And then you can take that to broadcast. So the fans learn. That element of the job has gone away since lockdown.
I just remembered a funny story about when Graham Taylor was Villa manager, dear old Graham Taylor, who is just such a lovely man. But there was one Villa game where Richard Wilford from WM was with me, and maybe somebody else. And we'd gone to interview Graham after a game. And Graham emerged in this room next to the main press conference room. And he had two guys with him who were, I think they were competition winners or something like that. They'd won the prize was spend the day with Graham Taylor. And as Richard and I approached with our mini disc recorders, as it was in those times, to do the interview, Graham turns to these two gents and says, right, now, what these two guys are from the radio, and what they will do is they will interview me, but what they might do is they might edit the interview so it looks like I've said things that I have not said. And I actually got quite upset. And I said, no, hang on, Graham, before we start, we don't edit a thing. What we play, we don't chop the, it's not like Good Morning Vietnam. This is, I think Graham was a bit taken aback that I'd sort of challenged him on it. And
for you, it's an insult to you to say it in front of people.
Yeah, and I didn't expect it from Graham, because he was such a delight to deal with most of the time. But that just gave me into an insight at that time into what managers who, what they think of us, what their perception is.
Yeah, we only see the veneer. We only see what they want us to see. They might hate us all, and they might never say.
Yeah.
They might not trust any of us, but they might pretend to.
Well, I've seen managers go off on one, a normally placid manager. You mentioned Steve Bruce earlier. I did a game, Reading against Hull, it would have been, and Steve, as usual, was being accused of nepotism about his son Alex getting game time ahead of somebody else. And I can't remember the scores. We're sat in that press room at the Medeski. Well, it's not called it's called the Select Car Leasing Stadium now, isn't it?
Yeah.
God, you've got to remember all these stupid stadium names, that Select Car Leasing Stadium. Anyway, Steve is sat at the top table doing his press conference, and I've clocked him on the way in and said, all right, for 2 minutes outside after, and he's gone, yeah, no problem. So I know I'm going to get a little short interview with him afterwards. And he's very, in this interview with the press, he's very curt and very short, a bit like you mentioned with Dallin Pardew. So it gets to the end of the interview, and he gets up to walk out, and I walk towards him and say, cheers, and he points at this guy on the front row from the Hull Daily Press. Is that
Hull Daily Mail.
I knew you'd know, Mark. Hull Daily Mail. And his face went bright red because he absolutely unloaded on this guy who'd written a story about him and Alex that he felt was clearly untrue. I'd never seen Steve go off like that. And it, of course, I wasn't recording, so it's not the sort of thing. It was all off the record. But this kid, who probably hadn't even written the story, but his paper had written it, honestly, he moved back several steps as this tirade suddenly comes from absolutely nowhere. Didn't see it coming, but like a volcano, he suddenly erupted. This kid is sent away with his tail firmly between his legs. And then Brucey turns to me, okay, Dance, let's go. And, you know, just
completely, on and off.
Yeah, completely back to normal. And then the interview I did with him, you would never have known what he was like 30 seconds before.
Yeah,
with this kid. And you talk about Strachan. I mean, Strachan, I've only interviewed him once, and I've done shows with him when he's an absolute delight to do a radio program with. But as a manager to interview after a game, you're shaking your head as you look at me, Adam.
Well, I've got people who work here who've not recovered from it. I mean, you know, I was lucky. I arrived on the South Coast just after he left, to be honest. But the stories still go on. And when he turned up, I was sort of shaking my head because when he turned up on Sky or whatever as a pundit, I was like, seriously? You hated the media and you're quite happy now to take the coin and sit there and be nice as pie. You know what I mean? It's like pot black and all that, and pot kettle black. I just thought, crikey, you really going to summarise if I don't? Because I've literally got people who were nervous interviewing. You know, they used to come back as nervous wrecks. Some of them still work here. Mm-hmm. They've got, and it affected them. It literally affected them because he did it for 2 or 3 years to them. And it's really sad. But I think managers tell you what they need to do. I mean, you talk about Brucey there. Paul Cook got off the bus with Ipswich last Tuesday.
I saw that, yeah.
Portsmouth news reporter, 4 or 5 years after he's left.
Yeah, but they won the game. I mean, I did see that video. And yeah, like Mark said, Mark saw it too. It's basically, for those who haven't seen it, Neil Allen from the Portsmouth News is there as Ipswich come off the team coach. And Cookie is shaking hands with a couple of people, spots Neil Allen, who must have written something that he's disagreed with, and he said, you wrote a load of about whose dog is that?
That's my dog, sorry. Little dog.
All right. All adds to the...
Paul Cook.
Little Rottweiler. Paul Cook gives this guy an absolute... It's only 20 seconds as he's walking past him, doesn't stay to have a conversation, but stop it, please, was his final final bidding to. So, yeah,
that's probably 4 years ago?
Yeah.
He's still worrying about what Neil Allen's saying. Just go, when they say we never read anything, I think, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Never listen to anything, never read anything.
You never experienced Gordon Strachan, did you, Mark? I mean, obviously, he was a Leeds hero, winning, you know, part of the title winning side in the early 90s, but of course, you weren't in the game at that point.
No, I didn't have. I've seen him in a press conference and seen how spiky he can be. It's a great point you make about the managers have got personas that they'll be laying into someone and a minute later they're fine with you. It's very interesting. I think if the public could see that side of the managers that are in charge, I think they'd be surprised by some of what goes on, definitely.
Did anybody terrify you particularly, Mark, in terms of a post-match interviewee?
Lee Johnson, I never seemed to quite get on with. He's an interesting one, Lee. He can be quite fiery, but to be fair, he's also been good as goal with me. So I guess it's just how you find him and how you come across him, isn't it? Yeah. You know, but I've been lucky, really, that in the access that you get. And I think, again, like Adam mentioned, when you're covering a team week in, week out, you do have a rapport. You do want the team to do well. But there is that element of when they don't do well, it doesn't half make your job a little bit more interesting.
You know, but that's when your honesty you talked about earlier comes into it, because you call it as it is and the fans respect you whether they're winning or losing because you're going to be honest. So you get away with it rather than be blamed for every defeat. You
know? But as sports editor with a responsibility to maintain relationships with Southampton, Portsmouth, Bournemouth, Hampshire. You know, you've got to tread that line, as I've mentioned to, you know, other people on this podcast about, yes, you're being honest, but you know, sometimes you might feel, oh, I don't know whether I've overstepped the mark there, because either Cortese or Rupert Lowe or somebody's going to...
Yeah, I got banned from interviewing the manager by Nicola Cortese, but that's because I just made an honest opinion about something. So you have to go, well, as long as I know I've not done anything malicious, not done anything to purposely upset someone, you can sort of live with it. And I always say we're biased and objective. You know, of course, I go into the games. I know who I'm working for. The licensed fee payers of the South Coast, they're Southampton fans listening to the commentary. But it doesn't mean if Arsenal score a great goal, I'm going to say, well, that was lucky. You only went around seven players. You know, so, I always remember the Pompey fans applauding Thierry Henry when he'd had a display at Fratton Park. And that's what I'm on about. You can want your team to win, but you have to appreciate the other side when they're just a better team. And if your team don't play well, you say they don't play well. And over years, if the audience trusts you and they know you're honest, then they will generally accept your opinion as probably the right one on the balance of things. You never keep everyone happy, but the secret is not to try, just to be yourself.
Yes.
And by the way, I've had as much problem with fans as I've had with managers. You know, when you're commentating as a one on a particular side of the fence, like with a club, and you've got fans sat right in front of you in commentaries, that's always fun. You two haven't had too many run-ins, but I've had a couple.
I had one at Birmingham.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah. No surprise, Dan.
Bolton, FA Cup quarter-final. Chung Yun Lee scored in the 92nd minute. Yeah. Bolton won 3-2. Me and my summariser going crazy, as you do. We're on Bolton local radio. And three guys stood up right in front of the press box and turned around. There were three skinheads, and they looked mean. And they were just eyeballing us. And I actually said to Gary Henshaw, my co-commentator at the time, said, well, I've got my glasses on, Gary. I don't think there's a guy with glasses on. genuinely, I thought we could get smacked here. I was quite frightened. And we went about 3 weeks later for a league game. Same three guys were there, good as gold. I had a laugh about it, but at the time it was like, hang on, we're going to get hit here live on the radio.
You are exposed, aren't you? You're literally, I mean, I've had it at Stoke and Watford because the fans are literally sat in front of me on an open desk just below me at sort of waist height. Their head is at waist height on that desk. I had a Stoke night, Mark, where, well, Dance, I think Saints won 3-2 in a League Cup tie. Peter Crouch came off the bench for Stoke against his old club, got sent off. But when we were commentating on it, the Stoke fan stood up, who was in front of me, flicked the V's at me, right, and called me something. And in instinct, I gave him the finger back. I had to think, I'm looking for the BBC here. I've got to be a bit careful. I gave him the finger back and Dave Merrington went, get in there, my son. like this. And all the fans are on Twitter going, get in there, Adam, like this. I'm like, oh, my God. And then at Watford Dance, I dropped, you know, people wouldn't know, but the commentary area at Watford is very similar to Stoke, as in just an open, nice, big, flat desk. And just by where your desk is, there's people's heads in front of you, fans. And I get excited when I commentate, guys. My hands might go. I'm animated. You know, my one hand, the spare hand. And like I'm doing now, talking to you. And I had a water bottle on the edge of the desk two or three years ago. And as I was commentating, I turned to Dave, put my hand out, and I knocked this water bottle, it landed straight on this bloke's head, right below me in the seats at Watford. And he stood up holding this water bottle. And as I did it, I went, and I swore on air. It was so instinctive. I went, And then because I'd sworn, I swore again because I'd sworn. So now your brain works in the space of a split second. I went, oh, shit, like this, and twice. And everyone at home's laughing their heads off on the radio. And Dave's looking at me like, what have you just done? And the fans having a go at me, I was like, you know, those moments I love. And the fans remember that more than the goals, by the way. They remember things like incidents or times you make them laugh more than the goals. That's what you've got to remember. You're entertaining people.
Pure Partridge, that, isn't it? I did. I had a day when I went to Burnley, Walsall, in my Cub reporter days. But I was doing a full commentary. It's probably one of the first commentaries I did, Burnley, Walsall. And I think I had to get the unused goalkeeping sub to be my co-commentator because we didn't have anybody. So I had to go and ask Ray Graydon, have you got anybody spare in your squad that could come into the game with me? And for the life of me, I can't remember his name. It's not important to the story. Anyway, Darren Rack, who you may remember used to play for Walsall, scored an absolutely astonishing 30-yard goal to put Walsall ahead at Turf Moor. And as you say, for the benefit of my local radio audience, I've gone crackers. Absolutely ballistic with this goal. It's a beautiful strike. And these Burnley fans in their flat caps sat in and around me at Turf Moor. Suddenly they give me the Gareth Hunt Nescafe. And for the next 10 minutes, they're not watching the game. They're watching me because they're waiting for me. You know, they're waiting for me to say something they disagree with. Luckily or unluckily, about 5 minutes later, Burnley equalised. And again, they weren't watching the goal go in. They were, again, giving me the old Gareth Hunt. As if, there you go, stick that up you. You know, the cockeyed intensity of football fans and what it makes them do to somebody who's just... I was just describing what was a brilliant goal, that's all.
Yeah, they should be celebrating the goal, not worried about what you're saying. It's hilarious, isn't it, how they get preoccupied.
Honestly. Mark's dog's off again.
The postman must be walking up the street. In fact, he is, so he's going to go crackers in the next couple of minutes, so I apologise for that. He's only a Bichon Frise, as well as a right noise machine.
Well, we like it, scratch and sniff podcasting. That's what we like, you know, real life and everything. We are coming to the end anyway. We've had over an hour chatting about this, that and everything else. The postman has arrived. Mark, obviously, Super League now has finished for the season.
Yeah.
But takes over with TalkSport now. I think we'll have some time together to work at the World Championship darts at Ali Pali over Christmas. What are there any things you'd like to fulfil at this point? Because as Adam rightly said at the very start of this, we're all very lucky in that we came into this late. We've had, 10, 20 years at this when lots of other people have had 30 years and haven't got to the position that we find ourselves so fortunate to be in.
Yeah, I don't know, really. I always consider myself to be so lucky. And I think, any point, it could all end tomorrow type thing. You know, it only needs a change somewhere further up the chain. It could all change. And I'm more than aware of that. I think doing the darts has been great. That's given new opportunities. I do like cricket. I was a reasonable player as a youngster. I'd like to do some cricket, I think. I think that would be something I would like to get involved in. But in terms of, we did the Euros in the summer, obviously in London, but still a privilege to be part of it. I take everything as it comes. I'll never say no to anything. I think that's something that if... And it would be commentator. Don't say no to anything. Just do it. Do it. Give it your best shot and have a go at doing it. You never know where it might lead. So an open box as far as I'm concerned. If anything comes along, let's do it and see where it takes us.
A Rugby World Cup would be nice, wouldn't it? A Rugby League World Cup, that is. I mean, to be front and centre with that would be...
It would be. Certainly in Australia or New Zealand. I lived in New Zealand a little bit as a younger lad, so it'd be nice to go back there.
I can hear it in the accent.
Yeah, of course you can. There's always things. I guess travelling. I mean, you've been lucky enough to do that. You've been around the world travelling and watching sport. I think that'd be something that probably would be the pinnacle, maybe, if you offered me that.
Okay. Adam, what about you? How many years have you been sports editor now?
17 at Solent and then 4.5 at Northampton I left WM. By the way, when I left WM to go to Northampton, everyone in Birmingham said, what are you going there for? It's a backwater. What do you want to leave Birmingham for? You've got no sport at Northampton. And then all of it kicked off, like I said, with the rugby and Rushden. And I remember thinking, you've got to do better to be a big cog in a small wheel than a small cog in a big wheel. I would never have got on air enough at Birmingham because there were too many people ahead of me. So I think take chances, like Mark says. Say yes to everything. Do what you can. I love the fact that Mark's story and mine are so similar and yours, Dad's. I spent time in Australia as a youngster playing rugby. So we've got these similar life experiences and I think it gives us a different view. But my ambitions now, I'll be honest, have changed. I'm in my early 50s. The key for me is my passion for what I do. I still spend hours doing my colourful notes for commentaries and everything. If I lose that, then I'll worry about everything else. I enjoy seeing my younger people develop and get good and go on to other things. That's very satisfying. So in my job, I get different elements of happiness. It's not just about the commentary. But I'm lucky. I've done European rugby finals. I know I'm not going to be on network radio. Let's be honest. I could have had chances in the past. But I've got now, after 17 years, enough knowledge to enjoy my job most of the time because I know the people, I know the audience. I think I work hard for them. So my satisfaction, I don't need anything now. I don't need that. I don't need a World Cup or anything to make me happy. I like the relationship I have with my people I work with and with my audience, who thankfully appreciate me and Dave, say, on a Saturday. And while that continues, I'll be happy. As long as I don't lose my passion, I'll keep doing what I'm doing. I'm quite happy with that.
Great stuff. So what's going on this weekend then, chaps? Mark, what have you got on?
I am at Leeds against Wolves on Saturday, and I'm at Barnsley against Sheffield United on Sunday. That should be blood and thunder, hopefully.
Ooh, absolutely. And of course, Southampton, where are they this weekend?
They're at home to Burnley. We've mentioned Burnley a lot today. Yeah. They're at home to Burnley. They're looking for their first win, of course. Saints got theirs last week, so that's going to be an interesting dynamic, because I don't think Burnley are as bad as their results suggest. So I think that's a tricky one for Southampton. Then they've got Chelsea away in the League Cup on Tuesday night, which we'll be at Stamford Bridge, obviously, for that. And then I'm away at Watford. So they're just into a phase now of winnable league games after what was a tough start. So
when you go to Chelsea with COVID restrictions still in place, the nosebag in the Chelsea press room is not necessarily what it might be. It's just...
Don't worry. I went there a few weeks ago and was equally disappointed, Dan.
Just a quick one on that, Dan. So I did my first ever game for Bolton Wanderers at Chelsea, and I went into the press room. I got there ridiculously. I was there about 3.5 hours early. I got there and I saw this feast of food, and I thought, I've only got a tenner on me. There's no way I can afford anything at that table. And the guy come up to me and says, "Oh, you're not eating, sir." I went, "Oh, what do you mean?" He said, "Oh, the press food, it's over there. Get stuck in it." I'm like, "What? This is where you get in the press room?" I thought I'd gone in the corporate bit.
Yeah, it's like a wedding feast.
Yeah, it was. And I'm like, didn't move, because I just ain't got enough money to get anything.
Those that don't know, you go to Chelsea and there's two hot meals available. There's a veggie option and a meat option. Then you've got cold meats, cold cuts, salads, breads. There's three different types of puddings. They've got a big jar, which has normally got eaten mess in or something like that. Mm-hmm. There's a hot pudding, like a steamed sponge with a custard. There's little bits of, there's prawns you can add to your salad.
Yeah.
For goodness sake.
Salmon and all sorts. I'm always surprised the moose actually makes it to his seat when I see him at Stamford Bridge, to be honest, boys.
Well, he's normally carrying something back out to the seats after half time, like piled high like a pyramid. But Moose has complained at Watford that he only gets sandwiches. He once got torn off a strip. You're right.
I'm on Mark's front. I'm privileged to get free food.
Yeah,
I'm with Mark. Yeah. I'd happily pay a fiver for what we get.
Exactly. Even though, like at Southampton, when I saw you last weekend, Adam, you know, you get a sandwich bag to take out to your seat. Brown paper bag.
So everyone knows it's because of COVID. We can't eat in a press lounge at the moment. Yeah. Some grounds you can. I don't understand it.
Yeah, so you get a sandwich, a piece of fruit, a bag of crisps, a bar of chocolate, and a bottle of water. Great. That's really nice. Thank you very much. You know, they thought about that. In fact, Southampton in pre-COVID times used to offer that to you on your way home. So
you'd have a meal
at lunchtime, but they'd have the sandwich bags ready for you for your drive home.
You know what, guys? We're a long way away from Harrogate Town or Hensford Town. I mean, you've got to stay humble, haven't you? It's a privilege to get free food. You think about some of those away games we did with non-league teams and stuff, just getting a pie or a burger with onions yourself, buying it. I didn't even know I could have expenses. You know, so I never try and forget that. We're not just the lucky thing, but when I'm watching a Premier League football match, you know, I appreciate it's my job to work hard to try and do my job well, because most people would swap in an instant. And I know it's not about luck, like we said, but we need to remember we are in a fortunate position, I think.
You know what? I think that's the perfect place to end it right there with my two guests on the Commentator's Curse this week. Mark Wilson, thank you so much, sir. Good to see you.
Cheers, boys. Thank you.
I'll catch up with you at some point, hopefully at Ali Pally, if not before, fella.
Definitely.
And Adam Blackmore, thanks as well for your contributions, fella. And
cheers to you, Dan.
I'll be recommending more great rock music to you that comes into my ether as it comes on, because I know you and I share a love for great.
I'm always amazed you're a Birmingham City fan, Dan, because we're so similar.
Hands across the expressway. That's what it should be. More of that, I tell you. Adam, Mark, thank you so much for your time. That's episode 10 of The Commentator's Curse. Please feel free to subscribe and rate and review and let everybody know. It's got into the podcast charts last week. I can't believe it. It's just ridiculous that this little one-man band podcast gets into the podcast charts. It shouldn't be allowed when you're up against all these juggernauts producing podcasts, like 10 a day, that are all produced to the nth degree. But that's all because of great people like Adam and Mark that I get on shows like this, who make it such fun to do. So thanks to those guys. Thanks to you for listening. And we'll be back next week with episode 11 of The Commentator's Curse.